Hello and welcome to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my guest, Tim Callahan-Martin. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Joan. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm even happier that the sun's shining and
I
it's
know.
Easter.
It's wonderful weather, isn't
Lots
it?
Lots of chocolate.
Very Good Friday.
Yes.
Very, very good Friday.
Tim is also known as King Stammers.
For all my sins.
Indeed. And is an all-round good egg. And I had to get that joke in because it's Easter.
Thank you.
Yes.
Well, fiver's in the post. Thank you.
No, great guy. And you've run a regular gig, don't you, read it between the lines?
Yes. Once every month, it's now once every other month to White Rock Bar in Ryde, called Reading Between the Lines, and it's now morphed into a collective as well, who are gallivanting around the country invading other people's nights and drinking all of their cider,
going across the Solent to the mainland.
Yes,
I believe.
Yeah,
whatever next.
We're radiating outwards slowly, trying to make nuisance of ourselves.
Oh, and entertain.
Well, that too.
I so enjoyed the one we did at the Ventnor Fringe last summer.
Thank you.
In the tent.
Our second birthday. That was a really awesome time. I loved that.
There was a little bit of magic in the tent that night, wasn't there?
Amazing! An amazing lineup from start to finish. Yourself, like right at the start. That was such a good way to kick off the gig as well. And you know, Rex and JJ, who came down from London. I don't think we could have asked for.
No, they brought a special vibe with them, didn't they?
And everyone on that bill, Ivana, and my God, it was just such a fantastic
lineup. Packed, wasn't it? It was lovely. Yeah. Absolutely lovely.
Really struck gold with that one.
So today we're going to be talking about journeys, and we can interpret that however we fancy, really. So from the physical stuff to how we move through life, how we get from A to B, and just talking around that. So, Tim, can you kick us off with one of your lovely poems?
I can. Well, as you mentioned, today is about journeys, and I don't know if our fine listeners can tell. Originally, I grew. I'm not from the island originally. I grew up way up north in a place called Stoke-on-Trent. And if you're aware of it, I'm really sorry. There is help and therapy and guidance available, but nonetheless, I actually got in quite a bit of trouble with the law, and I had to end up leaving Stoke for pastors new. And this is about that. It's called My Confession.
Thank you.
It's been 15 years since my horrible crime. And as weeks became months and months became years, you all forgot about me in the fullness of time. And I've stayed quiet till now. I've been in shame. And I've watched on conflicted and let innocent parties take the blame. It's time to come clean now. Time to stop living this fraud. But in my defense, I never claimed to be perfect. I'm human, I'm broken, I'm wretched, and I'm flawed. And what I did was heinous. I regret it to this very day, and hour by hour to the very core of my soul it is eaten away. It's time to finally do the right thing and eliminate any shred of doubt. Joan, my confession is this. 15 years ago, I was the one who let the dogs out.
Oh, you got me all panic-stricken and worried.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm actually going for the panic button under the desk. Tim, that was mean. You set that up really well, though.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
So why, obviously, I mean, judging by your accent, you really are, truly are from Stoke-on-Trent.
Sorry about that.
But why the Isle of Wight? Why did you come here?
Long story short, I was doing an apprenticeship at a printer's in Stoke-on-Trent. I'm sure you're lovely listeners don't understand why I'm called King Stammers now. Long and short of it, in many ways, the printing industry is a great barometer for socioeconomics, broadly speaking, because the first thing to go in any company's budget is advertising.
That's right.
So the moment that print work starts drying up, you know there's a recession coming. The apprenticeship I had was only valid and only functional as long as the company I was at stayed in business. They went bankrupt, so I no longer had an apprenticeship. So having poured the last 2.5 years of my life into this, I had nothing. I had no qualifications. I had no job. And at around the same time, my mother got offered a job on the Isle of Wight. My mother is a science teacher and a force of nature. And I sat there and I realized if I stay in Stoke, I'm going to be unemployed. There are no job prospects here. there is no room for advancement. I will spend out my days living in a high-rise council flat waiting for a break.
So you came to the island, blue
exactly.
seas.
Because if you're going to be unemployed somewhere where there's a beach, for
somewhere
crying out
beautiful,
loud. Exactly.
Yes, indeed.
And I, to this day, legitimately, I still think it's the best move I ever made.
You and me both.
So many reasons.
It's a very special place, this island, isn't it?
It is. It really is. And don't get me wrong, I agree with people when they say, there's problems with living here. Yeah, I totally get that. But for better, for worse, this place is 10 years behind the rest of the country. For better, for worse, it's nice to be able to walk home at night and not have to worry about being mugged. It's nice to have a very relaxed way of life. And what you lose in terms of things like amenities and certain facilities that you would have in big cities, like greater access to music venues of certain kinds, of theatre, of more of the culture kind of thing. Look at what you've got around you naturally. Yeah. It's such a wonderful place to just come and collapse. And I still think arts and culture-wise, it's getting there. I mean, you look at what people like Jack and Vary are doing with the Ventnor Fringe. That's incredible. They're doing some amazing work.
This year, they were telling me they're trying to arrange for the Hover to go from Southsea right round to Ventnor.
Yeah.
For a kind of one-off for that Fringe weekend. Wouldn't that be amazing?
That would be incredible. Yeah. My goodness.
I'd do that, wouldn't you?
If I could afford it.
Yeah.
I'm poor. It's fine. Fantastic. And that's what I mean by they trailblaze when they look at things. They look at it and they think, okay, where is our target market? How do we get our target market down? I remember 2 or 3 years ago, they rented a double-decker Routemaster bus that came down from London on the, I think it was Friday afternoon, came all the way down, brought you on the ferry and deposited you in the campsite for the Ventnor Fringe. Brought you all the way down, door to door.
Brilliant. So, bring your audience to you.
Yeah.
Which is what we need to do here.
And market it as a holiday. Because it is. Ventnor is a beautiful, beautiful place. The island generally is. And especially that part of the island. Why not come down, take a few days out, catch a few shows? And
when you get the Fringe, it comes alive, doesn't it? Ventnor, even more so than usual, because it's a really artsy little town. It's really hip and happening for that.
Yeah.
You can feel the energy just walking down the streets.
And where you look, there's lots of people trying to push interesting things happening on the island. I mean, in Ryde, you've got Sean and Debbie, who own Right Rock Bar, who are... They're everyone's aunt and uncle in the Isle of Wight music scene. And they were actually, when I started reading Between the Lines, they were... one of the few venues who were willing to take it on. In fact, they were pretty much the only venue that was willing to take a risk on it. You've got people like yourself, you've got John and Dom with Corduroys, you've got I could go on for days, and then you've got people like Nye Russell Thompson, who Stammermouth, who's doing incredible theatre work that's going up to Edinburgh Fringe and winning plaudits after plaudits and getting nominated for so many awards. I understand people's criticism when they say, oh, but we don't have any banging nightclubs. Yeah, totally agree. Go to Portsmouth for that. There's so much on our doorstep, and all you need to do is just dig a little deeper.
Mm. And when you go to these spoken word nights, you get such an eclectic mix of talent, don't you? You get people like Donna Jones up against someone like you. So all very, very different. It's wonderful.
And that's what I love about it, the fact that we now have such a variety. I mean, when I started reading Between the Lines, coming up for 3 years ago now, there was nothing like that on that. That there were no spoken word nights. That's why Sean and Debbie were the only promoted venue owners who were willing to take it on, because they love risks, they love challenges, they love looking at things and going, well, we don't know if it's going to work, but let's give it a try.
There's nothing like live performance for being a risk, is there?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's very easy to look at something that's doing successful and copying that. You look at something like Acoustic Originals, it's very easy to take that format and copy it because there's proven success with it. Turning up to a venue and going, hi, I want to do a night that's nothing but poets and spoken word. Maybe we'll have a comedian every now and again. We haven't done it on the island ever before, but we have these guys who they all write, and they write great material. And we're going to see how it goes. We might draw a big crowd. I mean, it's a huge thing in London and culturally in big cities around the UK, and especially in university towns, but there's not a history of it down here. And every single venue we pitched it to went... come back in about 6 months when you're established.
The old chicken and egg thing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And now it's to the point I wouldn't want to move it, because in many ways the Knight has sort of grown to fit White Rock and what we can accomplish with that space.
But that's really nice, isn't it? Yeah. Then it becomes an organic thing.
Exactly. And the fact that we have like the little cubby holes for installation artists, and we've got the screens at the back for projecting people
that
doing
makes
live
them sound
arts
like little gremlins just kind of doing some stuff in a murky corner, Tim.
The reason I have to go at that is because I know what arts installations are coming up for Halloween and Christmas. In terms of weird things scuttling away in a corner, stay tuned for that one. I can't say quite yet.
Have you got anything before Halloween? Because that's a long way off.
We're going to be doing one in May, dates to be confirmed.
Okay.
We normally take June, July, August off because festival season. And then we'll come back in a vengeance for October, November, December, all over Christmas, going through to about... going through to... August again.
Yeah, fantastic.
I think we'll do something in August. We have to do something in August. It's going to be the third birthday.
Definitely do it. Do it, because it was such a success. Repeat that.
Thank you.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
Definitely. Because I've got a bit of a confession. The very first spoken word event I went to was on the Isle of Wight. And being a bit of a virgin of such things, it was a complete anathema to me. I had no idea what to expect, and a lot of it I found quite difficult to get my head around. And then I kept going, and that's the secret. I think if you've never been, try it. So that's what I'd urge you to do. Just go along, and then go along again, and go along again, because then you're in the groove, aren't you? You get it.
And my advice is that if you are looking to start out, when we started, there was nothing. And now, in the space of a couple of years, we've now got three that have sprung up. We've got Corderize over in Ventnor. Cows has got Cowspeak, which is run by Adam Gatchell, which is a lot more anarchic, a lot sillier. And we've got mine. And I'm not entirely sure how to describe mine, other than...
a damn good night out, I'd say.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I heard it once described as a literary rave inside a Mighty Boosh curated thesaurus. I'm not entirely sure whether that was an insult or praise, but I'll take it for what
I'll
it is. Thank you
that.
Very much.
I'll praise, Tim. I used to teach Noel Fielding from Mighty Boosh. Yes. So knowing Noel, if somebody's compared you in mentioned you in the same sentence, I'd definitely...
Oh, I'm a huge Mighty Boosh fan. I'm extraordinarily happy with it. Just go along to each one and have a word. We're all a very lovely, friendly bunch.
Yeah. And as an audience member, I would say go, even if the first time you kind of can't get your head around it at all. Don't let that put you off. Go again, and then go a third time, and just see where you are, because sometimes you need to see the performers a couple of times to get their work and hear the work over again. And it does, you know, it's like a good song. It bears listening to over and over again, and the sentiments and the words. So definitely keep trying.
Ivana's great for that, I find. Ivana Popov, you can listen to her work over and over again, and every single time you pick up on a particular nuance that you didn't get first time around.
Yeah, and when you're listening, it's a real skill to listen, isn't it? Listen well. I think you hear something, and then I tend to, because I'm so focused on that bit, I miss the next bit. And then the next time I hear it, I think, oh, that's brilliant. I didn't catch that first time around. So there's always something extra to take on. And depending on what mood you're in as well, I think. You interpret the work differently, don't you?
Oh,
it speaks to you in a different way
to,
without sounding, you know.
It entirely comes down to the context of the environment. Mm. It's why I think each of the three nights work so well, because they're all so very different spaces and very different approaches to how to put on a night. But they all essentially come down to the same idea of people getting up reading words.
Having a go.
It's all about wordsmiths, but it's about the application of that and how you do it in different ways. And John has such an incredible way of structuring Corderize and nurturing talent. I don't quite know how he finds it.
He's very inspiring. He inspired me to get up and give it a go, which was to read from my books, which was quite daunting because it doesn't rhyme. It's prose, you know, but he was up for that and very encouraging. He was fantastic. And thanks to him, I, you know, then branched out into a little tiny bit of poetry, so I wrote two. But, gave me that confidence, that initial push.
There you go, entirely. And what I love about spoken word is that it can take so many different forms. I mean, one of the best spoken word sets I've ever seen was a gentleman called Henry Rollins, who used to be the frontman for a punk band called Black Flag.
Oh, yeah.
And he now tours around talking about his old tour diaries and recount. It's more of a raconteur type approach, really. But it's so entrancing because, as you can imagine, you know, touring, you know, being a touring punk band during the Reagan years, that was quite an intense environment.
I can imagine.
And he's full of some fantastic tales.
Well, all the performers have got backstories, haven't they? They've got their backstory is as interesting as their work, hence why they produce such great stuff. So, how did you come about writing and, you know, getting into spoken word yourself, Tim?
Goodness me. Okay. In many ways, the stories of my night is the story of me as a performer. The two are very kind of interlinked. I started writing poetry when I was about 14, 15, 16. Looking at me, I think you can guess that I wasn't exactly the kind of kid that fitted in when I was at school. Especially in a place like Stoke-on-Trent, that is, back then, it was a place that didn't hold much truck with arts, culture, lofty ideas of, you know. So when you say, "Oh, I want to become a writer," everyone looks at you and like you wandered in from the surface of Mars. I genuinely mean this. You know, the most ambitious kid in my year wanted to become a taxi driver. So I carried on writing, and for the most part, it was just writing for my own therapy is the wrong term, catharsis, I think is a better way of wording it. And it wasn't until I went to university that to explain, I went to university in London.
Mm-hmm.
So all of a sudden, I was then exposed to spoken word nights, and I was going to spoken word nights at the point in time where, you know, it was the tail end of guys like Scroobius Pip and Kate Tempest and Joshua Idaho before they exploded into the national consciousness and sort of went from being people who were doing nights like Bang Said the Gun and becoming these people who commanded ridiculous fees and performed to theatres full of punters. And I was absolutely inspired because at that age, it kind of dawned on me that, well, why can't I get up and say these things I've written?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're probably not very good. That's for an audience to decide.
But that takes a huge amount of confidence, doesn't it?
Well, this is where we get to, that when I moved back to the island, I saw an advert, I think it might have been a post office, that's just the patina for it, for a poetry meeting in a coffee shop. And it was a little place just off of Old Shanklin High Street. And it was the very traditional caricature of what you expect a poetry night to be. You know, lots of dour-faced people in berets, you know, drinking coffee, or that, you know, they're buying one pint between them and sharing it around. And all the very sort of avant-garde material about death and similes with waves and flowers. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I do like that kind of material, but it was an entire afternoon of the same thing, and it was the same people who, it was obvious between the dynamic of everyone that these were the same people who came in, month out, and there was no structure to it, no formality. It was just a group of people who met in a cafe, read what they'd written that month, and went off into the night again. And I got up to perform something because I, you know, it was billed as an open mic, so, you know, they said, "Oh, can I have a slot on the bill?" And yeah, I went up, did my set. And that was the first time I ever performed anything I'd written in public. I mean, I'd written scripts for short films, but that's a very different process. When you make a short film, obviously there's an editing process there.
Yeah, it's not raw, is it?
Exactly.
Exactly.
And I sit down right afterwards with my cup of tea, and this guy comes up to me and he sits next to me and he leans in close and he goes, "Are you happy?" Excuse me? Sorry, sir. "Are you happy?" That was absolutely awful, and Philip could have had a 10-minute set if you hadn't done that.
Oh.
That was terrible. Don't ever come back here ever again.
Tim.
We don't want you here.
Oh, no, that's awful.
And that's the point where I sat up and I thought, well, yeah, okay, they're right, I'm terrible. And I went home, back to my flat that night, and in a moment that I am perpetually ashamed of, I stood in the car park outside the flat where I was living, and I burnt all of the pages that I performed that night.
So,
and then about a week later, I sat up and thought, how dare you? How dare these people who claim to be guardians of poetry, rather laughably operating out of, you know, their friend's cafe on a Sunday afternoon for, you know, the price of a few cups of tea. You are no more the guardians of poetry than the Kennel Club are the guardians of dogs.
Well said.
How dare you take something that someone has written and turn it against them in such a fashion that you make them feel ashamed? Because it takes a lot of guts to get up there for the first time and perform something in front of an audience who, you know, there are going to be people in that crowd who are far more accomplished than you. And that was the big one for me. That was the moment when I thought, okay, thinking about this logically, there's lots of people on this island who are writing. I'm writing. Buddy Carson's writing. Lady Robinson is writing. Adam Gatrell is writing. We should just put on a night in much the same way that you would with a band or with an acoustic musician or some DJs. And you have a really eclectic lineup and we just say £2 on the door. Whatever money we make gets split equal ways. And we'll focus on making it a nice, comfortable environment for people to read. Because be damned if I'm going to let people like that ruin it for other people. That angers me. It really angers. It's something that goes right back to my youth. That how dare you rob someone of that opportunity to try?
That's a great attitude. And unfortunately, not everyone is able to react like that. Are they in the moment? No. You know, they go, they crawl away, and never to darken anybody's door.
Again. I did it. I went home thinking my stuff was awful and burnt my pages.
But you quickly were the phoenix rising from the flames, Tim, weren't you? And sadly, I think a lot of people would just turn on the heel and say, "No, you're absolutely right." You know, play into their insecurities. You're absolutely right. I am rubbish, and that would be it. You know, put down their pen and never write again. So, all power to you for turning things round, and what a positive part of your journey. But listening to your story, and you obviously feel very, very passionate about that, as you say, very cathartic moment. But I think, as with all sort of bad, I think good comes out of it. Mm. And in that weird way, I think there's something to be grateful to that guy for, because it was the wind between your wings, wasn't it? It was like,
in many ways. I'm not going to thank him. Because I'm a horribly vengeful human being, so it's not that.
But he gave you some real strength there, and real determination and grit.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's so empowering, and that's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's lovely to meet someone that's had such a horrific, nasty experience, just downright, experience of humans at their most unpleasant, and to have, you know, treated it with the contempt it deserved.
I'm not a vengeful man. I don't take pleasure in Schadenfreude or karma or anything like that. But what I will say is that of the two people involved in that conversation, one of them has been published, has performed festival, runs a successful chain of nights that started on the Isle of Wight and has irradiated across the UK. We've now got ones in Portsmouth, we're setting up ones in Bristol, in Farnham. We're doing fringe shows in Camden Fringe, V Fringe. We're looking to do Edinburgh next year. One of them has gone on to do things. One of them is continuing to grow and develop, not just his own work, but to create an environment for other people to perform and to nurture things, which we'll talk about later. But the other one doesn't read anymore. I'll
leave it there, shall we?
Yeah.
All right, we'll be back with you straight after this break. Thanks for listening.
The Lunchtime Social, brought to you in association with White Fibre, providers of the fastest fibre optic broadband on the island. Call them on 01983 240 240. That's 01983 240 240.
This is Vectis Radio.
Vectis Radio also offers a chance to broadcast your very own show.
Very own show.
Do you fancy being the next Chris Moyles? Or maybe you'd prefer to work behind the scenes instead? If the answer to either of those questions is yes, then get in touch.
Get in touch.
Email ian.mac@vectisradio.com.
Vectisradio.com.
Vectis Radio really is a true community station.
Community station.
Giving back to the community
every single day.
We are Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Andy Gustar has details of the £10 meal deal at Hamilton's Fine Foods.
Oh, that's been running for quite some time, and we're still doing it for £10, and I think, why change something that's really working well? You get a fresh chicken in there, 400 grams of steak mince, you get a pound of sausages, and you get a quarter of ham. All of that for £10. There's a lot of meals there for a family of two or three. The important thing to add to that is it's quality food as well. You must, I think, for the sake of your own health, look to a quality product which is going to be that good for you.
Hamilton's are in Newport, they're in Pyle Street. Where else are you?
We're in Cowes High Street, Wootton Bridge. We also have a shop now on Dodder Industrial Estate.
Hamilton's Fine Foods, the best local butcher in town.
Beds of Ride, in-town parking in Union Street. Come and give your bedroom an overhaul and treat. No need for sales gimmicks, just value for your pound. With realistic prices all the year round. Includes free delivery if you live in Ride. And only £10 elsewhere, island-wide. Open 10:30 till late, 6 days a week. All that is needed to help you sleep. Beds of Ride. Call 565 151. Also find us on Facebook.
The White Military and Heritage Museum. Situated on the main Cowes to Newport Road, the museum will excite your senses. Adults and children of all ages can experience the surge of adrenaline on an armoured vehicle ride around the tank track. For a real treat, why not try a ride in one of the Centurion tanks? There's also a covered rifle range to test your shooting skills. Enjoy refreshments in the cafe or the mess bar. Come along to the White Military and Heritage Museum, where you will be welcomed with open arms by our volunteer team. All profits are redistributed among armed service charities. Call 01983 300037 for more details or to book your ride.
Celebrate life's good, bad and banana skin moments with me, author Joan Ellis, in my new show Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls. Join me every Friday between 1 and 2 when I'll be chatting to a host of guests, including writers, poets and celebrity islanders, Jan Toms, Barbara Mackie, Donna Jones MBE, Gail Middleton, King Stammers and Dom Curran. We'd love to hear from you too, so why not ring in and join in the conversation every Friday between 1 and 2.
Stay social and get in touch. Add us on Skype. It's Vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
The Lunchtime Social, brought to you in association with White Fibre, providers of the fastest fibre optic broadband on the island. Call them on 01983 240 240. That's 01983 240 240.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and the lovely King Stammers.
Hello.
Hello. As it's Easter, and it's such a gorgeous sunny day, but it's I know it's about other things as well, but it's a lot about the chocolate, isn't it, at Easter? And chocolate has been with me every step of the way in my journey, quite literally, because it's, I don't know about you, Tim, but it's how I learnt to walk. My mum would be one side of the dining room with a big slab of Cadbury's Dairy Milk, enticing me across the carpet, and I would be staggering like a very
small... That's a genius idea.
Very small. Up to a point. I was then hooked from a very early age.
Frankly, we'd have been hooked on chocolate
well,
anyway.
That's true. So anyway, it worked. It was better than any carrot, I tell you. yeah, so I was walking in double quick time, thanks to that. Never lost the taste for it.
This might be why you're so productive.
Maybe, I don't know, I'll run on something. So as it's Easter, like I said, I'd just like to read a little Eastery thing from a memoir, The Things You Missed While You Were Away, which is an open letter to my dad, who wasn't around for a lot of my childhood, or my daughter Sophie's. And it's those magical moments that he missed, and but it's saying, don't worry, you don't have to be part of a regular 2.4 kids and a dog family to be happy, because love comes from unexpected places to fill your heart. So this is an Easter when I was a single mum bringing up my little girl when she was about 6 or 7, I suppose. One Easter, I remember buying Sophie an egg the size of a house. I needed a mortgage to pay for it and suggested we spent the rest of the holiday enjoying simpler, less expensive pleasures. We decided on egg dyeing and together secured leaves around the shells with thread before plunging them into a pan of bubbling blue dye. Minutes later, we scooped them out and cooled them before displaying our works of art in bowls on the table. Having completed the homespun stuff, Sophie was keen to move into the 21st century and enjoy the main event, an egg hunt as organised by the Easter Bunny. It was raining, so our bobtailed friend had wisely hidden the egg inside the house. To cries of hot, cold, hotter, and finally you're boiling, she discovered her treat. Wow! The Easter Bunny managed to carry this great big egg all by himself, Mummy. Mmm, I replied, fingers firmly crossed behind my back. When I was her age, the Easter Bunny never hopped as far as my house, and as a result, I'm on shaky ground when asked to justify his existence. Mum and I made do with feasting our eyes on the shop windows, drooling over their magnificent confections, all of which were far beyond her pocket. Giant rabbits and chicks moulded out of shiny dark chocolate formed the centrepiece alongside an egg decorated with crystallised flowers and the words Happy Easter iced by hand. Next to it was a space for the recipient's name. Oh, how I longed to find that on the table on Easter Sunday with the words Happy Easter Joni piped in white icing. I never did. Guess the Easter Bunny must have eaten it. Every year, Mum would give me a foil-covered egg, which I would try and make last as long as possible. I loved unwrapping it, smoothing out the coloured wrapper with my fingernail, before breaking into the egg, snapping off a small piece of chocolate and letting it melt in my mouth. Life didn't get much sweeter. Back then, we knew nothing about calorie counting. The nearest my mum got to a diet was crisp bread, thickly buttered. One was never enough, so she'd eat half a packet on the trot and still feel virtuous. These days, Easter is as commercial as Christmas, with eggs immediately replacing chocolate Santas on the shelves. When Sophie arrived at a friend's birthday party, she was greeted by a pink chocolate fountain and happily joined the other children dunking marshmallows into the rose-coloured pool. All I wanted to do was lie under it with my mouth open. Recently, when her father was away working and couldn't get to see her, I treated us both to a hot chocolate. It was magic in a mug and made her smile. The waiter tempted us with dark chocolates infused with exotic flavours like red peppers or Earl Grey tea. I shivered with anticipation as a white-gloved hand proffered the plate of sweets. Sophie took one, bit into it and pulled a face. At a pound a pop, I ate both of them, then felt a bit sick. Thank goodness the Easter Bunny had the good sense not to bring me the sophisticated egg I wanted, or thought I did. Over 40 years on, and a piece of chocolate snapped off an egg still tastes better than a square from a bar. Dad, we both love chocolate. Guess that makes me a chip off the old block. Happy Easter.
And a happy Easter to you.
So do you have any special Easter memories, Tim?
I do, in a great many ways. Much like yourself, my mum was a single mum. For most of my childhood, and I remember that Easter and Christmas were the two times that as a teacher she would just put everything aside and we'd spend a week together, but when I say that, please don't think that my mother was constantly too busy or is at work or anything like that. Her door was always open. I could always go talk to her, but I'm sure, as you understand, having worked in teaching, that when you are a teacher, your workload is phenomenal. So it was always a very special time when the family would come round and everything else would be put aside and it would be family time.
Oh, that's lovely. Yeah, because you do appreciate it, don't you, when your mum works.
Oh, yeah.
what it feels like when you're a child 24/7. Of course it's not, but no. Those moments when they are there, and they're, because my mum used to be so tired, you know, she was shattered, she was a nurse, and when she finally got home, she had a long journey, it was, you know, it was very hard, very difficult to kind of, you know, get her to be present, because she was so exhausted, God love her, all the time. And when you're a child, you don't understand, do you? Because it's all about you, and you think they're going to be delighted to see you, and you can rush around and have fun. But you know, they're just living a life, and they're trying to, you know, make everything, well, both ends meet in the middle, aren't yeah. they? Work, fun, home,
job. I was very lucky in many ways. My mum is amazing. I would confidently say I've got the best mum in the world, and I will fight other people with a differing opinion. And yeah, and my whole family, generally speaking, have always been incredibly supportive in many different ways.
What makes... Is your mum listening now?
She might be. I don't know. I think that we have family down at the moment.
Okay.
As ever
well,
can.
If she's not listening now, she can listen again on next Saturday.
Where can she listen again?
Yes, next Saturday. But I thought you could, you know, give her a little tribute.
I don't actually have any poems about my mum. Oh, God, I feel awful now. I'd queued one up, and it's not to do with
But I know you said some lovely stuff about her at the Ventnor Fringe. You got up on stage, and your mum was in the audience, wasn't she? And that was
yeah.
magical.
I mean, my mum is wonderful, and she continues to be wonderful, and she is one of the most supportive influences in my life. It's right down to things like when we first started the Spoken Word Night. I'd had a huge gas bill through that month, and I sat there, and having paid my gas bill, I could buy groceries for the rest of the month, or I could buy posters to publicise the gig. And I walk into the copy place and I look at the price and realise, well, no, it's fine, at least I'll be able to, you know, eat something other than beans for the rest of the month. And I walk out without any posters, and she just looks up at me and goes, where are your posters? And I say, well, gas bill and, you know, no posters. And she slides me 20 quid and says, get as many posters as you can out of that. And if it were not for that, that gig would not have happened. And continuously, she's so supportive. I can't put into words everything she does. I'm so grateful for everything.
That's
really
lovely. Are you her only child?
No, Lord, no. I have a stepbrother and a stepsister who still reside in London, Alex and Justine, if you listen to this. Hello. I have an older brother called Rick, who also resides somewhere around about Stoke. If you're listening, Rick, hello. And again, there is quite a large sense of family within our group. Family comes first in amongst everything else, you know.
Yeah, it is special, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's those little things that only they know, they understand, they get you, don't they? They get you like nobody else, and can get away with murder as a result of it.
Well, I've been making a professional career out of that for years.
I disagree. Come on, give us another one of your
okay.
lovely poems.
This is one about, on the subject of journeys, it's an unfortunate realisation that sadly not all of us make it out. This is a very personal one to me, and it's dedicated to a friend of mine who passed away a couple of years ago now. He was, the guy was a jester. He lived to entertain people. He was always acting the fool to put smiles on people's face, and with festival season just around the corner, it's a reminder that we're not going to see this guy again, because for me, he was synonymous with festivals. I wouldn't see him for like 4 months of the year, and then festival season would roll around and I'd see him every single weekend. And this is about, well, I got thinking about that, and this is about that. This is called Around the Sun. Hello. Yeah, it's me. Sorry, I've been sent here by the bloke upstairs to remind you that, yeah, sorry, we are all going to die. And no, I'm not being facetious, if you're wondering why I'm standing here in front of this microphone being oh so morbid, but I'm just lost on this idea of aging being something that's so, so sordid. I know I should act my age. I'm rapidly approaching 30, yet I dress like I'm off to a Mumford & Sons gig and my demeanour is still far too flirty. But I'm okay with this, because clocking up more days is a privilege denied to many. We only have a finite amount of time on this soil, or years are not ten a penny. And I'm sick of this media's obsession with living fast and dying young, as if turning 76 is really such a terrible fate with which to be stung. Maybe it's just me. Yeah, I've got so much I want to go and see and do, so many places to go and visit and so many scrapes to get into. We were forged into this world, from stardust and sand. And for all I know, this life we get to live right here is the only one we live firsthand. I don't know, you know, maybe there is an afterlife, something wondrous and pure in its divinity that justifies the strife, but why take that kind of risk when all is said and done? Because we don't clock up anywhere near enough years orbiting that beautiful, precious little sun. So far, I've had 11,557 rotations of this Earth's axis, and I've tried to live each day true to myself, and I'm proud of this. But I think it's time that some of my generation recontextualises how we think about growing old. Because when the bloke upstairs finally drags me off this stage, if I've entertained some of you, then, well, to me, that's a life worth its weight in gold. Cheers.
Thank you. Thank you. Wise words, Tim. Wise words and beautifully put. Yeah. So we've heard your wisdom and certainly your wit. Will you please share, as the name of the show suggests, a prattle? You're my first, the first guest I've actually asked to fess up to this, so here we go.
I couldn't settle on any one particular pratfall, so what I'm going to do, if it's okay, I'm going to perform a number of poems of a humorous nature and tell the story of when I was young and made a massive fool of myself on stage. Actually, no, there is one I might be able to carry away. I was one of the last generation of kids to try and woo a member of the opposite sex using cassette tapes and mixtapes, where you record songs off of CDs and on the radio and that kind of thing. And I made you a mixtape. Will you go out with me? The answer was invariably no. I'm not sure if we can use that as a platform. This is about this. Mate, what's going on with you and Susie? Is it serious? Lads, I've made a mixtape. They all reply and shock their mouths agape. A generation sonnets came with the warm fuzz of a C90, a 5,400 second long declaration of love that could make you feel so high and mighty. Two sides to play at DJ, and a stratosphere of tunes from which to curate, although the quality of the six pack from Curry's was something to debate. And if they included some Nirvana, well then I knew they were a keeper, because a mutual love of Kurt Cobain could only make our love so much deeper. And there's a part of me that still thinks if you made me a mixtape, my heart would be yours. But if you are going to include any Jim Morrison, please make sure it's Early Doors. This is about a pratfall, in
but
a sense.
How did that mixtape go down?
There were four or five mixtapes that were made for various ladies. And one guy as well, but we won't get into
what
that.
What was the best reaction the mixtape got?
Oh, thank you. Broadly speaking, no.
You wouldn't recommend it as a courting gesture.
I think it's more that I was never exactly, shall we say, the most viable of suitors.
Perhaps it was more that your taste in music didn't gel with their taste in music.
Oh no, I think it's entirely more to do with the fact that how do we word it, cuddly.
Tim, you are adorable. If I wasn't married, I would marry you myself.
Oh, well, thank you very, very much.
Yes,
my goodness,
you are one of nature's great people. No, but nobody ever made me a mixtape, and I don't know if that's a generation thing. But you're talking about cassettes, aren't you?
Yes,
old
C90
tiny tapes. Little cassettes. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. It's weird actually. I suppose this is a pratfall in a sense. I performed that gig at a students' union about 4 months ago now, and I stood on stage and went, "Who remembers cassette tapes?" And it was just an echo chamber all the way back. It just everyone's like, brother, they're like floppy disks. And I have never felt so old in my life. That was a bit of a crushing realization of you're getting older.
Yes.
It's
you could because they haven't sort of, they're not like vinyl, are they? They haven't made this kind of trendy resurgence.
They have to a degree. There's a lot of punk bands that record on tape, purely because when you think about it, how many people still have cars that have cassette players in them? Mm. And plus it's...
Do they still snap? They used to snap and unravel themselves, didn't they?
We always used to joke when Headfunk was a live entity, for your listeners who don't know anything about me, and I don't assume you would. I'm part of a group called Headfunk, and we used to stage nights where we'd play music very, very loudly and drink lots and lots of rum and have super happy fun times in basements with bunting. We always used to joke that we were going to sell cassette tapes of a mix of one of the nights that was going to come with a pencil, and if you're old enough to understand why you needed the pencil with the cassette tape, you get it for free.
Yeah, I get it. Yep. So perhaps when you perform, perhaps you could just whip one of these old cassette tapes out of your pocket, and would that help? Little aid memoir.
I don't get booked for that many student union gigs, really. It's you know, they want exciting people like Mark Grist. They you know, they, yeah, well.
When I talk Noel, his end of term piece, his final piece, was to come on as Jesus Christ on a pogo stick.
That's quite an image.
Yeah, and I suppose quite apt for Good Friday, in a way, isn't it?
I suppose, yes.
Goodness only knows where that one came from, but that was Noel.
Having watched his projects post Mighty Boosh, I can see where that came from. Yeah.
But another, I mean, you know, I describe you as an all-round good egg, and he certainly is. He's, as you see him, is the guy you get. Mm. You know, he's absolutely lovely. And when I was working at the college teaching him advertising, how to be an art director, which is what he was going to be before he became a, you know, world-renowned comedian, I was on a 3-month trial at the uni, and I can remember the principal called me in and he said, Joan, we'll be keeping you on. I said, oh, marvellous, thank you very much. And he said, yes, Noel thinks you're very good. And I thought, Noel, I don't know any members of staff called Noel. And I said, Noel, he went, yeah. I said, you don't mean that first year, do you? And he went, yeah, that first year, Noel Fielding. I was like, oh, really? So... God love Noel, you know, I had a career forged from that one comment, I think. Yay. But they, more to the point, they were listening to him. You know, the principal of the college was listening to Noel Fielding, who was just a sort of 18-year-old, 19-year-old first year then, and taking, you know, his opinion as read, which is amazing, isn't it? So they'd obviously all spotted something in him fairly early on.
Oh, he does have it. I don't quite know how you could define that intangible factor of it, but the there is a charisma about him
that
you're very naturally drawn to. He's fantastic.
Yeah, I went to the Albert Hall last year and saw his art, private view of his art exhibition.
Oh, wow.
Which was great fun. It was lovely to catch up with him again, and he's kept friends with a lot of the guys on the course who do animation for him and all sorts of, so all those skills are kind of come, and he's just kept them all close, which is so lovely. You know, he's kind of got this mates band that, you know, do stuff with him, which is fantastic. But it was lovely seeing his work and, yeah, just catching up with him after all these years, because obviously he's gone on to perform on a much bigger stage, as I knew he would do, because his ideas were so outlandish and over the top and brilliant, you know, just far too brilliant for a client to want to buy for a product.
What I absolutely love, I mean, I was a fan of them going back to when they were doing stuff on BBC Radio. And I never got to see any of their fringe shows, but and I think in many ways it was a matter of them having to wait for the rest of the world to catch up with them.
Yes,
they were so ahead of their time when they started out that the BBC just weren't ready to put that kind of condensed madness out at that point in time.
Yeah, he invited me to one of his shows. I think it was at Her Majesty's Theatre. In London, and I went along not having a clue really what to expect, but was pleased to have been invited, and just hordes and hordes of young fans, you know, he just filled this theatre. I thought, good grief, you know, this is Noel. But he's fulfilled his destiny, hasn't he? Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, you can't see him doing anything else.
No. Born to perform. Yeah. Yeah, he used to do fantastic work, and I'd say, you know, you just do that, because I thought, don't quash him. Don't try and make him sit with a brief.
No.
And fulfill, you know, be confined by those boundaries that you have to within a professional brief, because I knew he, you know, he had something that nobody else had that was going to go and do far bigger things. So it's lovely to see him doing so well. It's fantastic. So we've got a few more minutes. I'm just going to read. We're talking about journeys, and I know you're familiar with this one, Tim. It's based on The Killing of Mummy's Boy. It's the opening sort of couple of pages.
Oh, goodness me.
And it's a very dark journey.
Oh, I'm looking for a pillow. Oh, God.
Yes. So, as you know, I met a killer on a train, and people said to me, well, why didn't you just move? I was coming back from Waterloo to Portsmouth, and they said, why didn't you just get up and move? Any normal person would have done, I suppose, but I didn't. To be quite honest, I was just too terrified of him, because he had, by that point, already told me what he was capable of.
Rabbits in headlights.
Yeah, and I thought, if I provoke him, he could do anything. And on public transport, people aren't exactly renowned for leaping to your aid, are they? They tend to sort of hide behind their newspapers and look away just in case they don't want to get involved.
Well, it's the age-old logic of assuming that somebody else will take control
of
the situation.
Yes, exactly. So anyway, I thought, sit tight, just be pleasant, and let's just keep him calm. But that didn't really work, because he then thought I was, I don't know, kind of sending him mixed messages, and invited me to run away with him at the end of the journey. So after the 90 minutes, he suggested I ditch my husband and run away with him. So I said, no, not today, thank you very much. But having had that experience, I thought, wow, you know, he's given me such an insight into the workings of a criminal mind. I've got to put pen to paper. So it's set here on the island, and it really is, you know, it starts from this kind of terrifying journey, really. But it's a fictionalised account of what would have happened had the woman this killer met said yes. So it's that story reimagined, really. It was Sandra's first journey back to London since she'd moved to the Isle of Wight a few years before. Having a stretch of water between her and the mainland made her feel safe. The Solent could be expensive to cross. Some people thought twice before making the journey. She liked that. Once on board, she'd found an empty table, taken off her coat before absent-mindedly plucking a stray blonde hair from a cardigan. A man watched her from the aisle. She followed his gaze. To her embarrassment, her fingers were resting against her left breast. Flummoxed, she struggled with her case, making several unsuccessful attempts to lift it onto the luggage rack. "Here, let me," he said. Now it was her turn to watch as he swung the case up over his head and positioned it on the shelf. His white T-shirt rode up, revealing the lower half of his torso. Her eyes tracked the thin line of black hair that ran from his navel and disappeared under the waistband of his jeans. He flopped into the seat opposite. She looked at the box of cakes in front of her. Just donuts she'd bought from a kiosk in Waterloo Station. "Did you make those?" he asked. They were obviously manufactured, the brand name emblazoned on the side of the box. She shook her head. "My sister bakes cakes for Cath on Ride Beach. Do you know it?" She glanced at him, momentarily trying to picture him, thinking perhaps she knew him. But she didn't. She shook her head and checked her phone. No messages. She sighed and slid the phone into the pocket of her handbag, where she kept her Oyster card. But the travel card wasn't there. Oh, she must have dropped it after topping it up at the station. Luckily, the card was registered, so it wouldn't lose money. Quickly, she took out her mobile, scrolled down and clicked. "Hello, I'd like to report a lost Oyster." Sorry, can you hear me? Yeah, my name's Sandra Williams, Dove Cottage, Isle of Wight, PO305AB. 5AP? P for Papa? No, it's B. B for... "Bravo," the man smiled over the top of his newspaper. She gave him the thumbs up by way of thanks. "B for Bravo," she said. "Yes, the card's registered. Hello, can you hear me?" The line went dead. Irritated to have lost the signal, she sighed and locked her phone. He threw down his newspaper, making her jump, and reached into the pocket of his jeans. Fanning out three Oyster cards, he pushed one towards her, his nails bitten, his cuticles ragged and bloody. "No, thank you, it's yours. Go on, have it." "I don't need it, I'll get a replacement. Why have you got so many?" He shrugged, put the cards back in his pocket. "I always lose something when I go to London." "Where in London?" she asked, seizing the opportunity to talk about her hometown. "Leighton, the girls live there." ain't seen him for years. He said it as if years was another word for hours. She raised her eyebrows at him. Why not? I've been away. I've been inside. I slit someone's throat.
Thank you.
Okay, Tim, well, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's
and
been...
very, very happy Easter to you and your mum. And look forward to talking to you again, perhaps in the summer.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I look forward to it. Thank you.
And thank you all for listening. And I look forward to speaking to you again in a couple of weeks when I'm going to be talking to poet and powerhouse extraordinaire Donna Jones. Okay, happy Easter to you all. Enjoy your chocolate. Bye-bye.